Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is Josh Broner. He is the CEO of Tilson, and we're going to celebrate the fact that for the sixth consecutive year in a row, they're on the Inc. 5000 list. What does that mean? That means that they've had incredible growth, steady growth, unbelievable growth for six straight years. We want to know why. We want to know what you could learn from it. So let's bring them on right now. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Josh Broner, CEO of Tilson, a Inc. 5000, six-year in a row winner, correct?
True story.
True story. That's awesome. So, Josh, tell me a little bit about that because, hey, as you have said many times, to be on it once is great. Be on it six times consecutively, right? Consecutively? That's pretty impressive. Talk about that.
Yeah, thanks, David. So we've been on the Inc. 5000 list six consecutive years. And the first year we got on the list, we were a very small company. And so we'd experienced a roughly doubling of the company, and that got us on the radar to be on the list. But the challenge for us has been not just growing once, but to sustain that growth over time. And as we get bigger, to sustain a growth rate on a percentage basis requires a much bigger number. And so what characterizes our culture as a company is a lot of ambition. And so we continue to grow the company aggressively and roughly double it every year. And so our story of the Inc. 5000 six-year in a row achievement really has to do with our sustained growth over time and not letting our foot off the gas pedal.
So for those who are listening today, they may say to themselves, Tilson, what is Tilson? And so why don't you give kind of like a little overview of the organization, kind of maybe where you've come from to what you are today, and why Maine should be so proud?
Sure. So Tilson provides technology project management and deployment, and we do that in the IT and the telecom industries. For us in Maine, we started really growing in 2006. And in 2006, I joined the company as the third guy. And today we're about 200 employees with nine national offices. We do about 15% of our work overseas. So we're still largely a U.S. company, but increasingly we're global and working in several time zones. And so that's happened, you know, really over the last 10 years substantially.
No, that's fantastic. You know, as you've thought about this, obviously, that period of time, you've had a lot of growth in people. And so tell the audience a little bit about how those challenges have been overcome. And then we can talk a little bit about today's challenges. But get me to today.
Sure. So for us, the most challenging thing about our growth is finding the right team members to propel that growth. So as a services company, we don't sell products. We sell projects, and that means for us, we're a people company, and the thing that we're selling to our customers is our team's expertise and ability to get projects done. And so for us, our enduring challenge is how do you continue to maintain a double the company growth rate where you wind up with twice as many people as you had the year before and maintain the quality of people that have helped you be successful. And so for us, that's been largely about maintaining the peer group. And what I mean by maintaining the peer group is we've tried to find people who share our values, who come to work really excited to do the best possible work and support each other. And from an employee attraction and retention standpoint, I think a key ingredient to our success has been not compromising on those values of excellence in those employees, not just for the value of the next incremental hire, but to retain the people that we've hired before, they want to continue to work with that quality of a peer group.
Yeah, the words I have seen used is a fanatic commitment to hiring and retaining, quote-unquote, high-performance, happy people, right?
Yeah. That's a term that's been used. So explain high performance happy people, because high performance is pretty obvious. But how do you work for happy? You know, what's happy?
Yeah. So
I know the song Happy, but you just play it all the time, I'm sure. But
so of course people are different, and different things motivate different people. And as you go from organization to organization, you find that their cultures characterize birds of a feather, people who flock together. Who find something in common. And for us, what makes our employees happy is being high performing, is doing really great work. And so when I talk about the term high performance happy, it means what motivates people is coming to work with people who push them, who make them better, who they feel like are pulling their weight to their left and to their right. And not everybody goes to work with that same motivation. Other people find joy in working with people who share, you know, a common life story or background, or, you know, share a common interest. For us, the common thread between these employees who are incredibly different people is that they're happy doing really great work and working really hard.
So, you know, one of the things that always comes up, or is the question that some companies ask, how much information do you share with your team? Do you keep them apprised of that high performance? Because I would think if people are really truly motivated by high performance, they have to be kept involved really in how the company is doing, how the department's doing, how the project is going. How do you share that information in general?
Yeah, that's a great point. So for us, we have a high level of transparency with our employees in a bunch of different dimensions. A lot of companies feel that sales efforts and sales information should be confidential because it has a certain competitive implication, and you know, employees sometimes move on and go to other companies. And so we work differently. We have a totally transparent view of our sales environment. In fact, have a tool on everybody's computer with a stream of consciousness of everything that's going on in our sales world, including, you know, bids and bid information the day before it goes in. And our feeling is that it's better for us to keep people in the loop and oriented than to try and protect that information. If information walks out the door, that's unfortunate, but it rarely happens. And so we're betting on ourselves rather than thinking about the competition, and that means we wind up having a very open book with our employees about what's going on in the company.
From an HR perspective, sounds great, sounds amazing. How do you control the confidentiality part? Do you have, you know, do employees work under agreements or different ways to try to protect the company? And again, I'm just thinking from an HR perspective.
Sure. So every employee is party to a confidentiality agreement, which we find to be pretty typical with our peer group. The reality is that a confidentiality agreement can be challenging to enforce, and oftentimes if someone were to reveal confidentiality or confidential information, you wouldn't be aware of it. And so while we do have an agreement, which is just, you know, prudent practice and frankly required by most of our customers' contracts, our focus is on hiring the right people and trying to treat them as well as we can, and trusting them to do the right thing. Because in the end, we're trusting them to take care of our clients. We're trusting them to grow our business. We're entrusting our leaders and managers with the well-being of their teams. And so, frankly, the trust we give them in confidentiality is the least important of those trusts that we give our employees. We trust them with each other's life safety. And so if you're willing to trust them with that, I don't know why you'd try and keep other things, you know, confidential.
Excellent point. No, that's an excellent point. You know, one of the other parts as we talk about is that hiring piece, right? And so let's bring it to today's world. A challenging hiring market, to say the least, especially in the field you're in. What are some of the things that you're looking at to try to help fix that problem?
Yeah, so in our business, the biggest governor on our ability to grow is our ability to hire the people that we need. And at any given time, we have a deficit of 15 or 20 people that if we knew who they were, we would hire them today. And that would propel us into the next phase of our growth. And in fact, we turn down work every day because we don't want to overcommit ourselves relative to our ability to hire. In terms of what we're doing to help ourselves with that, we work in several ways. One, and the most important, is the word of mouth we have with our employee base. So we have 200 employees today. And our best next employees will come from people that those 200 people know. And we encourage our employees to think about who are the people that you have worked with or do work with somewhere in your life in whatever context, whether it's in your work now or in your previous work or in your volunteer life or in your school life? Who are the people that you respect and trust? We want to talk to those people. The second thing is that we've tried to view the potential employee pool as being much broader than the local market that we're in. And so now we conduct all searches on a national basis and often offer relocation. And so many of our main employees have come from Maine, and many of our main employees have come from other places. And similarly, with our national office footprint, we now have people doing work for clients in Maine and work for clients outside of Maine from any of our offices. And so we've tried to adopt a much more flexible attitude about where people can be. And in fact, while we have offices in 9 states, we have employees in 33 states. And so we'll find talent where that talent is and try and be very flexible about where they need to be in their life. Now, we do some work physically. We have people who work with their hands and do technology implementation work that's quite physical. And in that case, we have to have people close by to the place where the work is happening. In other contexts, in the IT work we do, for example, really people can live anywhere.
So in a previous show recently, we talked to universities and colleges in terms of their commitment to try to work with industry to develop, you know, if you would call it, the next generation of talent. Have you started to look at that as options or partnerships with colleges, university, nationwide, locally, whatever it is, as we notice that the skills gap continues to be a challenge?
Sure. So as a business with constraints on finding technology employees, that's something we worry a lot about. And so we think about it in two ways. At the entry level within our business, we have generally a pretty high need for interns. And so we work with local colleges and universities here in Maine and also outside of Maine to place interns in our business, particularly during the summer season, but also throughout the year. And many of our best employees started as interns and now are full-time employees or start as interns full-time in the summer but maintain a part-time relationship with us through the year as their studies allow. So that's one dimension. The other dimension we think about is that we hire a lot of senior seasoned technology employees. And today's students in a decade, when we plan to still be in business and growing, will be our more senior employees. And so we have a general interest in seeing enough students enter the pipeline of technology degree programs that we know we'll be okay when the time comes in a decade or more when those are more seasoned employees. But we're not very directly involved in the hiring of recent college graduates. We tend to grab people while they're still in school in the intern context or hire them when they're quite senior after they've had, you know, 5 to 10 years of experience post-college.
We're talking with Josh Broder. He is the CEO of Tilson. And we're talking about success in their sixth year in the Inc. 5000 reporting. Hey, you know, Josh, you talked a little bit about getting employees to refer people they know, people who they think would fit within the organization. Do you use programs like, do you have a rewards program for that type of thing for employees? And is that some way that you found to be really successful? Or what are some of the challenges you found with that?
So we have at times offered bonus incentives for employees who have provided a successful referral. And we tend to do that in situations where we're the most constrained. And so, for example, we have a division within the company that installs wireless facilities on radio towers. And when a cellular company is doing a big upgrade in a market, every climber imaginable is pressed into service and it becomes a really acute shortage. In those contexts, we have offered bonuses. What we're finding, though, is that those kind of incentives don't change behavior. In our experience, I suspect it's been successful in other contexts. But for us, we find that employees who are all in, who are engaged, who want to be here, are the natural emissaries for the company. And they're talking to their friends and family about joining a team they really believe in, and offering a financial incentive, while it could potentially help, generally doesn't change the behavior of somebody who's doing it anyway, who is highly motivated. And so we tend to do it when we're really in a bind, but generally we find that employee referral stream is pretty strong year-round, regardless of the incentive behavior.
One of the other areas that I know you're focusing a lot in is veteran hiring. has been successful for you. Talk to us about that. And since I know, you know, obviously we're here in October, and last month for the state was a big push to have veterans. Tell me a little about, you know, where you see Tilson going in regards to hiring veterans.
So Tilson is a veteran-owned business. I'm a former Army signal officer, and something that I'm really proud of about our company is that Tilson is a place where someone transitioning from the military can find comfort and commercial success. And what I mean by that is that one of the reasons why employers are excited to hire veterans is that veterans understand teamwork. And they come from an environment where not only are they responsible for performing highly in difficult situations, but they have a sense of responsibility for their team and their person to their left or to their right, for their safety, for their success, for their professionalism. And that's something we really highly value at Tilson. And so as those veterans transition directly from the military, when they come to Tilson, they find that to be a familiar and comfortable environment, whereas coming into a company without a lot of veterans or without a culture of very integrated teamwork, the rewards and the measurements can be more individualistic and less focused on the team's result. And so we're really proud that this is a place where transitioning veterans can come. As a result of that, the company is 50% veterans, roughly.
That's outstanding.
We're pretty excited about it. I mean, yeah. We know that in the industry that we're in, particularly in the telecom parts of our business, there are naturally a lot of veterans because many technical people get their technical education and start in the military. But even so, we think we're roughly double what the industry averages are, you know, relative to veteran employees. And we think it's because it's a good place to transition. And it's also a place where, because we have a lot of veteran managers, those veterans then have a network and make additional referrals. So I often get calls from other businesses and colleagues in different industries saying, you know, what's your secret to success relative to hiring veterans? And unfortunately, it's difficult to replicate the formula because it fundamentally has to do with the underlying culture of the company and the feeling of comfort, and also the personal metrics of the veterans that are in the company doing hiring, as opposed to generally posting an ad saying, hey, we're a place looking for other veterans.
Do you use a lot of collaboration with state services, with, you know, with veterans administration, with different areas to also get that word out?
Yes, we actually haven't. We've had some success at veterans job fairs in certain local markets where we've been looking for certain kinds of employees transitioning from the military. But generally, the veterans that we're identifying are coming from our own networks. And so someone who leaves the military and joins us will stay in touch, you know, with the 20 or 30 or 40 people in their professional network. And as those individuals transition, they've then heard of the success of this person who's here at Tilson, and they want to come and experience that themselves.
Since 50% of the organization has veteran status, do you find, and this is just a general question, you may not have the answer, but do you find that they are more loyal, that they are less apt to leave? What's the retention rate, veteran versus non-veteran?
That's an excellent question and something that we're just now starting to get data on. Generally, I would find that the thing about veterans is that they as individuals are as varied as any other set of individuals
in the group, right?
And so we find that the results really vary. What we find is that for some veterans, the fit with us can be short-term. It can be to come and find that first place of comfort for transition, and then they move on to something else. And so a good example I would give you is a veteran that has come from many tours of duty overseas and has been, you know, essentially traveling and living on the road may come to us and make a transition and travel for us. And it may feel very familiar. And then they may meet someone and get married and have a kid and feel that travel really isn't for them and they want to be in a local market. And it may be the last local market we had them in because that's where they met their special someone. And the right fit for them is then to transition to another business. And for us, we celebrate that transition because that means we've been successful with that veteran transitioning. We've been lucky enough to have them on our team for a period of time of dedicated service. And for them, the right fit and moment in their life is to do something that's next. And so something that's unique about our employment culture is that we don't have any sense of ownership over an employee. And what we mean by that is not that we're not loyal to that employee. We hope to retain people for a long time. We deeply value tenure. But we feel very strongly that an employment relationship is a period of fit and where everyone's needs are being met. And if there's a situation that's better for our employee as they transition, then we're excited for that employee. We're excited for them because we care about them as a human being and want them to be successful. But we also want to build a culture where people look at Tilson and say, that's a place I can come and further my career and be successful. And we don't want them to feel like they're either with us or against us. They're with us for a time, and then they're part of our alumni network, and we celebrate their success in their next job.
Well, Josh, I mean, that's an exciting way of thinking about employment, and sometimes I think that's a little bit different than other employers think about, so that's great information. We're talking with Josh Broder. He is the CEO of Tilson. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we're having a great conversation with CEO of Tilson, Josh Broder. Hello, Josh. Welcome to the show again. I appreciate you being here.
Good morning.
You know, I got to tell you, we've had a great conversation during the first segment, a lot about hiring, a lot about you know, some of the great things that are happening. And, of course, we're talking and celebrating the fact that for the sixth year in a row, you guys are on the Inc. 5000. We'll talk a little bit about that report in a few minutes. But I wanted to talk a little bit about engagement because we had this conversation in the first segment. We kind of briefly talked about it and how you talked about employees are truly engaged in your organization. As you know from some research that we've talked about, employee engagement is lacking in the country today. There's no question that there are fully engaged employees that are only about 26% of the workforce. And then there's a significant amount, you could even say 28, 29%, that are fully disengaged. That means there's a big chunk that are kind of just doing what they're doing, right, and making it happen. How have you taken and really made an organization that focuses on engagement so important in your organization?
So our starting point in building engagement is hiring the right employees. And we talked earlier in the show about this idea that our peer group was a group of high-performance, happy people. And because there's a high-performance, happy culture in the company, the engagement becomes peer-to-peer rather than individual contributor to management. And what I mean by that is the teams that we have working have a high level of autonomy. And so we may organize around a project and put several people who are expert in different things together to get the project done. And they have a shared sense of accountability for the project. While they may bring a certain expertise to the team, as a unit, they have a huge amount of autonomy to get that project done. And we're really focused on the result rather than the methods and materials that they use to achieve that result. And so the kind of people that are attracted to that environment and that we retain are people who are so self-motivated, that has such a fire inside to go out and do that work, that it's not typically a management drag-along. Typically, management is behind them in a supportive way, trying to make sure that they have the resources that they need. And so that engagement starts with people who were engaged before we hired them. And the idea that we actually don't bring that level of engagement to the table, our employees do.
You know, you mentioned the word ambition, right? Highly productive, highly motivated people. How do you hire people with ambition? Because that's not easily definable in terms of an interview conversation, or is it?
Well, interviews are hard. Interviews are hard, and we find that we try and avoid the trap that someone who interviews well or best is the best employee necessarily. But we do look for people who articulate in an interview, in our early conversations with them, what it is that they want. Because we talked earlier that in the employment relationship, fit is really critical. And if we can't deliver what they want, in their career, maybe we're not the right fit. Because if we're getting what we want and they're not getting what they want. So we're looking for our employees to have a reciprocal relationship where not only do we get the work done in the way that we want, but also that employee gets to further their career objectives. And in the interview process, an employee that can articulate those career objectives is a really good first step to understanding their ambition. The other thing is that the flip side of being a high-growth company, this idea of sustaining listing on the Inc. 5000 is that there's the constant creation of new opportunity. And so within the company, we've had a series of receptionists who have become project administrators and project administrators who have become project managers who have become directors and executives in the company. And so that progression is very visible and it's required. And so to be successful at Tilson, there isn't a sense that, you know, you're going to come and do something and it might last 2 or 3 years before there's a change. The minute you arrive, you're starting to realize that there's so much opportunity around you and so much expectation that you're going to step up and take on more that from a self-selection standpoint, the people that want to stay are the people that are comfortable saying yes a lot. And so we're looking for people that have that ambition, that can articulate it, but that will also, when asked, hey, this thing just came up and it's the hardest thing we've ever done before. And every month it's the hardest thing we've ever done before, the biggest thing we've ever done before, that they're willing to stay up and step up and take on more.
No, that's great. I mean, the fact that somebody can come in and already know there's multiple options for career paths, which is millennials, for example, that's a huge deal. They got to understand what their career paths are 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year down the road, and is there anything for them? Not that it isn't for other generations, and I am being a little general here, but the reality is that's an important piece of the puzzle. Is this fully developed? In other words, have you put in place programs that say, here's a natural career ladder for you? Or is it really more of a, if an opportunity opens, it's kind of more of a hit or miss type, left or right, you might be ready for this or maybe this or this. Is that more defined or is it more haphazard?
I would say it's intentional, but it's less structured. And what I mean by intentional is that one of the things that's really different for our business is that the requirement to have someone take on something tough and big is happening daily. And so the RPM of our business, the growth rate of our business, drives that constant creation of a manager, high-level individual contributor, sort of step-up vacancy. And so we're intentional about asking the team, who wants to do this? But I would say from a structural standpoint, this is not a place where you go from project administrator one to project administrator two to project manager one to project manager two. The prescribed career laddering, we feel, doesn't deal with the dynamism in our business, the change in our business, the frenetic pace of our business. And so the people that are happy with us is not everyone. So the dynamism in our business is the constant creation of new, big, hard, challenging projects. And the wonderful nature of that growth of creation of hard projects is people getting tapped on the shoulder and say, hey, here's something harder, different, disorienting, exciting, challenging, go do this. The terrible nature of our business is that people are getting tapped on the shoulder saying, here's something harder, more difficult, go do this. And so there are two sides of the coin to our culture of high growth, and it permeates everything about the company. And so when we interview people, we try and be very candid about, hey, if you want to come here, it's something a little different and it's not for everyone. And if changing into something more challenging the moment you get comfortable is not for you, then we're not for you. And so we try and be really upfront with people and maybe even scare them off in the interview process to make sure that's something they want.
Yeah, but that's good. I mean, I think people have to know what they're getting into, right? And you're going to have an environment where it's constant chaos, constant change, albeit controlled chaos, controlled change.
Right.
Right? Or at least mostly controlled chaos, controlled change. Urgent, you know, things are critical at all times. You've got more coming in, more coming in, more coming in, and they have to be able to sustain that.
They do, and I think different people have different levels of need for structure. And so for people who want a lot of structure, who want a handrail to lean on of business process and you know, and definition of exactly how the day is going to go, we would be a terrible choice. Because typically, because we're in a high-growth environment, our process is a couple of steps behind the leading edge of the biggest, hardest thing we've ever done before. And so we're looking for someone who's a bit more comfortable in that chaos and can maintain their composure in that chaos. And we talk a lot in our business about composure as a core value, and that means that it's not for everyone.
Have you used or thought of using assessment tools or anything like that to try to help that process along?
We have. We have thought about it, and we haven't done it. And I think that's just a feature of our
constant
growth,
yeah. And praise and pushing it along. I understand.
Exactly.
No, I mean, I think companies, you know, want to know, are there ways to help try to figure out people's, you know, measurements or tools in that area? And it's a helpful tool. I'm just asking the question.
Yeah, no, it's a fair question and something we've thought about. You know, if we could land on a tool set where we could predict people's comfort level with the kind of environment that we have, of course, that would be quite helpful for us. And because turnover can be so expensive and disruptive, assessing the right fit up front, spending a little more time doing that would help. What we have done is we've tried to get a little more formal about our searches. And rather than have somebody impulsively hire someone they know, we try and put that person in front of several individuals who are stakeholders in their hire, with the thought that it's very easy for an individual to have a blind spot relative to their evaluation of someone else. But once four or five people have looked at somebody, probably something super glaring isn't going to slip through. And so we've tried to take a more team-oriented approach to the interview, which has the added value of helping that candidate get to know us a little better and assess if it's the right fit. Because again, to circle back to the broken record of fit here, if they don't know us very well, how can they make an informed choice as a candidate about whether we're the right fit for them? And if they choose us without all of the information, then we've maybe set the situation up for failure.
So over the years you've been there, which has been how many?
I started in late 2006, early 2007, so coming up on 10 years.
It's hard to believe, I'm sure.
It went really fast.
Yeah, it just flies by.
Yeah.
You've obviously seen success, you've seen failures, you've seen things that have happened. What was the biggest challenge that you had to overcome as you, you know, grew in this business?
For us, it was taking on our first set of projects that were the biggest projects in the space. And what I mean by that is entering into the highest level of sophistication and challenge relative to the kind of client we were working for and the scope and scale of the project. We grew up in Maine as a company in a pretty friendly environment. And as we took on some bigger, badder projects for some sharper elbowed customers with Maine employees, we found ourselves in an environment where not everybody viewed the world the same way we did. And so there was definitely some growing up moments as we tried to figure out, hey, how do we compete with a multi-billion dollar company and step into their shoes in a really big project?
Well, you obviously have done well as you continue to work at the, you know, Inc. 5000. So talk about the Inc. 5000 for a few minutes. Why is it such a big deal? What in your mind, six times, it's fantastic, by the way, you know, why so excited about that?
So first, it's important to define it. The Inc. 5000 is simply a measure of growth, and it's a measure of growth on a percentage basis. So if you had a business doing $1 million in sales and it did $2 million of sales the next year, it would have 100% growth. And so for us, on average, we're experiencing 70 to 100% growth a year. And at $1 million to $2 million, you might achieve that with one lucky sale. The next year, it gets a little harder. You have to make two of those lucky sales to go from two to four and still maintain 100 million. Well, the next year, you have to go from four to eight. And then the next year, you have to go to eight to 16. And when you're talking in millions, while the percentage may be staying consistent, the number starts to become bigger. And once you've moved into the largest size, sort of the largest deal size that you could be doing, then you start to run into some serious scaling challenges to maintain that level of growth. So for us, what the Inc. 5000 has meant has not been that we had, you know, one particularly boom year. It's meant that year over year, structurally, consistently, we've been making the right bets on where technology is moving. We've been making the right investments on where we want to be. It's meant we've adopted a skate to the puck kind of mentality and somehow managed not to become calcified after the first iteration of doing that. and to maintain flexibility to continue to anticipate those changes.
I think that's a big challenge, isn't it, to keep the mindset still open to new and growing ideas, because what did work 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 years ago isn't going to work today.
I think that's true, and I think the natural human tendency to respond to any kind of trauma is to become more risk adverse and to build controls to stop that bad thing from happening. And we've tried to adopt a more measured approach where, you know, inevitably when the slings and arrows and a business fortune happen and HR problems occur and we make mistakes, that rather than overreacting and spending a lot of mental energy making sure there's 0% chance that will reoccur, we try and learn from the mistake. We try and take reasonable measures to prevent it, but we want to make sure that the medicine isn't worse than the illness. And so for us, that means not building bureaucracy and control measures to the point where we can't still be nimble enough to make those changes as they occur.
We're talking with Josh Broder. He's the CEO of Tilson. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Senator Amy Volk. As I walk through the neighborhoods of my district meeting my constituents this election season, one message is clear at every door. People are fed up with the political discourse in Maine and throughout the country. I couldn't agree more. I, too, am sick of the partisan rancor and name-calling. I spent 2 terms in the Maine House and 1 term in the Senate working with lawmakers from both parties to accomplish real change for the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton. In fact, the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation found me to be one of the most bipartisan legislators in Maine. This year, I was awarded a Certificate of Achievement from the American Conservative Union, indicating that while working in a bipartisan fashion, I was able to remain true to my conservative principles. It has been a privilege serving the people of Gorham, Scarborough, and Buxton, and I ask for your vote so I can continue the great work we accomplished this last session. I will return to Augusta and provide the experienced, principled, bipartisan leadership you've come to expect. This is Amy Volk. I ask for your vote on November 8th.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're having a great conversation with Josh Broder. He is the CEO of Tilson. We're talking about their success for the 6th consecutive year in a row of being on the Inc. 5000 list. Josh, you know, in the last couple segments, we've talked a lot about hiring. We've talked about employee engagement. We've talked about some of the success you guys have had and why the Inc. 5000 is so important. One of the key areas, of course, in HR and just in general in any organization is safety, right? Safety, safety, safety. I think there's a commercial for that. They're not a sponsor, so I'm not going to say their name. But there is a commercial for that. Having said that, safety is very important for any organization, especially since you're dealing with outside clients and highly technical things. Tell me about that. Tell me how you've evolved in safety, how you maintain a great safety record, all the aspects of that.
Sure. So for us, Tilson works in several life safety areas. We have technicians working at height on radio towers, on water towers, on building rooftops. We have employees working with high voltage electricity. We have employees driving all over the place, being transported by every means imaginable. And increasingly, we're working overseas. And so we'll have employees work in a dozen countries this year. So for us, safety is an important topic for us. We view safety in a couple of ways. First, we have an ethical obligation to make sure that our employees don't get killed or injured. And I use the word killed very intentionally, sort of not a common workplace word, but we do work in places where people routinely get killed doing this work. We have tower climbers, and in 2013, the death rate in radio tower climbers was roughly 1 per 1,000 per year.
Wow.
13,000 tower climbers, 13 deaths in 2013 in the industry. And so we take this ethical obligation very seriously. At a personal level, my previous experience before Tilson was being a military officer, and we took people to dangerous places where we expected them on purpose to put themselves in harm's way and do what they needed to do and potentially not come home. And as I embarked in this commercial adventure that is Tilson, it was critical for me that we never trade someone's life or physical abilities for money. It's something we're not willing to do. And so we feel really strongly about it. The other dimension is our customers feel strongly about it, and they measure it. And so our safety performance, in addition to meeting our ethical obligations, has a direct impact on the way our customers view us and has a direct impact on our cost environment. And so we're really proud of our safety record. We have a experience modification rating. That's the insurance industry's view of how safe we are of 0.72. And 0.72 doesn't mean a lot if you're not in the insurance numbers, yeah. But roughly one is average. Right. And so the way the insurance industry rates you is that if you're over one, you're worse than average, and if you're under one, you're better than average. And that number, in addition to being a number that our customers ask us a lot about, how safe are you, what's your EMR, is also the premium multiplier on our workers' comp insurance. So if your premium is $100 and your experience modification rating is 1.25, your premium just became $125. And so we enjoy, you know, roughly a quarter discount on our workers' comp because of our EMR performance. And so from our standpoint, we need to meet our ethical obligations to keep our employees safe, but we also need to make sure that we can give our customers comfort that we're a safe bet and we're not going to hurt someone on their job site, and then ensure that our costs are under control relative to insurance.
One of the other things that obviously happened here in 2015 is an increase in regards to the OSHA fines, especially when it comes to safety. And obviously, there's always training and development that needs to be done. Do you find the regulations to be overbearing? Do you find them to be a challenge that, you know, as they continue to increase? Just curious how the regulatory effect is on an organization like you.
Yeah, that's a great question. If I was at a roundtable of business leaders here, they might be kicking me under the table now as I say this. But I frankly think the regulations are too loose. It's my feeling that the basic standards imposed by OSHA and their enforcement is overly influenced by the industries that are being regulated. And what I mean by that is it's too much of a negotiation. The standards could be higher. And I feel that OSHA is underfunded. And so OSHA is a great agency working hard to try and meet their mandate, but they don't have enough people in the field to provide sufficient oversight. And so from my standpoint, we know we exceed the minimum standard, but we see some of our peers in the industry not doing what they need to do to protect their employees. And we don't think that's good for us. We don't think that's good for our future employees who could be hurt or killed or disabled in their employee. We don't think it's good for overall our insurance rate. So we'd like to see stronger standards.
That's certainly not what I was expecting to hear. But you know, in fact, I think it's great that you're honest about it. Is that, I mean, look, this is serious stuff. I mean, you know, we're talking about people's lives at stake. And the reality is that anything that can improve and help that is only going to help everybody in the long run.
Yeah, I agree with that. And so from our standpoint, because, you know, we don't, our point of departure for thinking about safety is not compliance. We know we're going to meet those compliance requirements because we spend so much time thinking about our safety program. And, you know, we do make sure we run through the checklist and, you know, the files are correct and the reporting is compliant and so on. But the way we think about safety, that occupies most of our planning time on this is building a safety culture. And for us, our safety culture has three main foundational elements. The first is empowerment, and that is we want to empower our employees to act and stop work when they think something is unsafe. And fundamentally, a serious accident has never occurred where somebody didn't see something and thought, that doesn't look right, and then they chose not to say something. And they didn't say it because they thought they'd get in trouble. They didn't say something because they thought they were too inexperienced. There was something that kept them from speaking up, and we want our employees to feel empowered to stop work and to not get in trouble for it. The second is transparency. So we have a reporting program that when we have what we call a near miss, that we report it. And the only reason we report near misses is to prevent future accidents. There's never a punishment for reporting a near miss. There's an investigation. That investigation is not to assign blame. It's to identify, boy, we got lucky in this situation, but something could have happened, and how can we prevent it from happening in the future? The final and most important foundational element in our safety culture is judgment. And the idea being that the safety and compliance generally focus on what I call the final factor in an accident. This would be the thing that happened to hurt someone. Someone fell off a tower and they weren't tied on. Somebody got shocked by this high voltage line because they didn't tag it out. And from my perspective, that's never the actual cause of the accident. The reason that, an otherwise right-thinking person made that mistake was that they were tired or under-trained or under-supervised or under-equipped, that the conditions were not ripe for safety. And so when I say judgment, I mean the judgment to know that it's time to call it quits for the day because it's too dark, too wet, whatever the factor, or the judgment to say, I'm just not comfortable with this task, and I'm going to say no and get us in trouble with the customer and get some training on this thing before I do it. And so those are the three things we talk a lot about in our business. And I feel like if we're focusing on those things, then the compliance takes care of itself.
No, that's very true. Yeah. I mean, the fact is that always if you do the right thing, compliance will take care of itself.
Generally, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's true. It's almost all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, compliance, I always find it's after the fact. You know, it's after the fact that you're compliant. If you do it right, you don't have to worry about that. As you said, compliance is the way it is.
Right.
So you follow the leads. What is the one area that keeps you up at night from a safety perspective?
So it's the tension between...
I know you have kids, by the way, and so that's a separate issue.
Right? Yeah, right. Okay, all right. That keeps me up for the few minutes that I am sleeping.
Yeah.
So what I worry about is that there will be a conflict in the sense of urgency that we have and our commitment to safety and doing the right thing. And so because that keeps me up at night, I spend 200 days a year traveling around my company, visiting those employees in 33 states and job sites all in 47 states, and getting face-to-face with those individual contributor employees and looking them in the eye and saying, it's my company, and if you think something's unsafe, I'm going to back you, even if it costs us money. And so in a place where people have a sense of urgency and accountability and want to be successful, and that's working really well at the lowest level, then the conditions, ironically, in that wonderful culture are ripe for a shortcut on safety. And so the way I'm trying to counteract that is to get face-to-face with those employees and let them know that their management team backs them on making the right call, always.
We're talking with Josh Broder. He's the CEO of Tilson. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. A News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're talking with Josh Broder. He is the CEO of Tilson. We've had a great conversation today. We have just a few minutes left in this conversation today. Josh, you know, you've done this for 10 years. Obviously, you're enjoying yourself doing it, right? It's something that you truly
absolutely
enjoy. There's no question about it. I asked you the question, what keeps you up at night? What makes you happy? What makes you really so happy about what you're doing?
So I'm a thank God it's Monday guy. When my feet hit the floor in the morning, I'm excited to go to work, and I love what I do. And what makes me excited about it is the team that I'm working with. When I worked in the federal government, I got to work with some of the best people I've ever worked with, and then some people with those best people I've ever worked with we tried to manage around. And the thing that's really fun for me at Tilson is that the peer group that I'm working with, the team that we have, is as excited to be there as I am, and they push me and they challenge me and they make me better.
You know, it's exciting to work in an environment that's upbeat, positive, and growing. As we used to say in the old days in retail, sales cures all ails, right?
Right.
You know, the more the sales goes, everything else just goes.
Right.
But I think that you've taken a lot of time and energy, if you really listen to today's show, it's really about putting the right people in place first.
Yeah.
Keeping them engaged, about making sure they're safe and happy, right? You use that term very fluently, happy. Mm-hmm. And then even celebrating when they leave, if in fact it's the right thing for them. You focused a lot on veterans. You know, 50% of the organization is in a veterans-owned group. And by the way, thank you for your service, for your personal service in the Army, correct?
Yes, in the Army. Yep.
So, you know, I think your organization has really not only earned this Inc. 5000, you know, award in terms of being recognized, but it's also continuing to do the right thing. Where do you see yourself and your organization, you know, 5 years from now?
So if you extrapolate our growth rate and we're able to maintain that same percentage, which is, of course, harder with each double, it's a pretty big organization. And so one of our challenges as we grow is to make sure that we don't lose the culture that we've built as we scale. And so my hope is that we can continue to take on larger projects and more geographically diverse projects without getting so big from a headcount perspective that we don't know each other anymore, that we don't have this collegial peer group, that we lose sight of the kind of people we want to have on our team and the way we support each other. And so I see us being substantially bigger, doing bigger, badder, harder projects, but I would say with a relatively small, lean team doing that work.
Well, congratulations on being in this year's Inc. 5000 for the 6th year in a row. We'll have you back when you're in your 7th year. How's that?
Sounds good.
Great. And you've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We've been talking with Josh Broder. He's the CEO of Tilson. It's been a great show today. You can go to hrpowerhour.com after the show and listen to the rebroadcast of this show as well as connect with Josh directly. And certainly if you're interested in a job that fits his type of criteria and culture, we'll have the link there for that as well. Thank you again, Josh. I appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VerylDana.com.
This is Tawny Alvarez with VerylDana. With upcoming changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act salary exemption level, it is best practices to perform a full wage and hour audit to make sure your practices are in compliance with state and federal law. Often, employers will categorize their whole sales department under the outside sales exemption without performing a complete analysis of the factors that must be fulfilled in order to qualify for this exemption. First, the employee's primary duty must be making sales or obtaining orders or contracts for services, or the use of facilities for which consideration will be paid by the client or customer. And second, the employee must customarily and regularly be engaged away from the employer's place or places of business. Accordingly, members of your sales team who are not on the road, but who instead perform a majority of their functions in your office, would not qualify for this exemption. Contact VerylDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group if you'd like to discuss more.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerylDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Jeff Fromm, president of FutureCast, is going to be talking about that large, big group everybody's talking about, millennials, how to get them and retain them, how to market to them. We're going to have a great time on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.